Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for January 4th and 5th, 2013, from sundown to sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com, themessianicmessage.com. I hope you enjoy this teaching. And before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who created everything. Holy are you, and holy is your name. Abba, we pray for the ingathering of the exiles and for your kingdom to be set up here on earth. And Abba, I just pray that you'll open up our understanding and that you will not let me speak anything that doesn't come from you. I pray that my words will drop to the earth and die, but that your words will live. I pray all these things in the name of Yeshua. Amen. This week's Torah portion is called Shemot. It means names. It starts at Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1 and goes to Exodus chapter 6 and verse 1. The Haftarah is Isaiah 27 verse 6 to 28:13 and Isaiah 29 verses 22 and 23. The Brit Hadashah is Acts chapter 7 verses 17 to 29. And I'm going to be mentioning in this Torah portion a lot of excerpts out of the book of Jasher, because Jasher really helps us to fill in details that we don't get from the books of Genesis and Exodus. Now, we are going to be experiencing another paradigm shift as we listen to the Torah portions moving forward. As a matter of fact, I've been trying to get this paradigm shift going in the Genesis Torah portions, because we need to begin to understand the legality of the Bible. We need to begin to understand the authority that the Lord has, and that it's not just some spiritual, nebulous, subjective, you know, if I want to do it or I don't want to do it kind of mentality. We need to understand that Yehovah, Yeshua, has legal authority. And if there's anything that we should be understanding in this day and age, it is about legal authority. Because right now what we're seeing in the world is that there is a legal authority that's being destroyed in the United States of America. And when the American legal system goes away, then the other Western nations who in the past have followed the American system of governance, those Western nations, those other Western nations' governments will fall as well. And there's a legal system that is rising based upon a deity that is being worshipped in another religion. And that legal system is called Sharia. And so the earth is the domain of someone's legal system. We need to start understanding and start acting like we understand that the Bible is the legal document for God's authority and ownership of this planet. It's not just some, you know, the Bible isn't just some kind of a guideline to live by. That's what we've been taught all of our lives. Oh, this is just these are just suggestions for you. No, actually, there is legal precedent in here. And everyone on earth is going to find themselves being judged according to this legal precedent. That's because the Bible is more pragmatic and practical than we understand right now. So I'm trying to get us to make this paradigm shift. And you know, it's hard because we've all in the Hebrew Roots movement shifted from one religious view to another. But now we're going to have to make an even bigger shift. it's going to be a bigger shift for us. It's not just about the spirituality, but the legality of it. And that's an even bigger shift than just spiritually coming out of Babylon. Now we're going to be legally learning how to come out of Babylon. The reason that we have the ancient Near East covenant language that is used by the pagan nations is not because the pagan nations established this legal system, but because it was established by Jehovah, then used by the pagan nations. So the Bible is written in this ancient Near East covenant language that the children of Israel and all the pagans around them would understand forever. You know, we try to make it seem like we don't understand the covenant language, but really we do understand it because the legality of the Bible plays into our spirituality. And it's this legality, again, that is going to cause the pagan nations of the world to have no legal claim to the land of Israel, which is our inheritance. Now, in this Torah portion, we're going to study that the children of Israel are trapped in Egypt, just like we are. You know, we can't just pick up and go back to Israel. We are bound in Egypt. We're bound away from the land by political and military realities. Now, we do have people trying to return to the land individually, and I'm not going to say anything about whether or not you should or shouldn't. If the Lord leads you to go over there, then you need to go. But from the book of Jasher, in fact, it's in Jasher chapter 75, it talks about 30,000 Ephraimites who got tired and decided that they were not going to wait anymore. They thought that the time of the Exodus had already come and that they were just going to pick up and leave. So 30,000 of them tried to do that and they were killed. Here's what it means to be trapped. It means you've got to get someone else to come and release you. And see, that's the job of the Messiah. See, back then, when the Ephraimites left, well, they had not yet seen Moses come from the mountain. And so, we are still waiting for Yeshua to come from the mountain. Now, in this Torah portion, the list of names, the Shemot names, establishes exactly who it is that is trapped in Egypt back then and today. And oddly enough, the same list of names applies today that applied back there. So here's what it says, starting in Exodus 1:1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. Notice that these are sons of Israel. Who are we? We're sons of Israel. And we are in Egypt. We came to Egypt with Jacob. Each with his own household, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Remember, 70 is also the number of the nations. And Joseph was already in Egypt. So there are 12 listed there, including Joseph. So what Shemot is doing here in the first few verses is establishing the current condition of the children of Israel now that they are bereft of their protectors, you know, Jacob and Joseph. Now, we just finished Genesis where we saw that there was a Hebrew who was prominent in the Egyptian government, and his name was Joseph. And the very next account then in Shemot is the account of another Hebrew man who is prominent in Egyptian government. Now, this should be an encouragement for this, for us here at the end, because it shows us that somewhere there are Hebrews hidden in the pagan governments of this world. I truly believe that there are Hebrews who are in the government, and for us, that's going to end up being a good thing. Now, let's just go back and recount the story of Genesis, because it's important for us to understand the overview of Genesis going into Shemot, because now we're going to learn about ourselves at the end of days. What happened to them is what's going to be happening to us. Now, in chronological order going forward, so from the beginning, what we have is this story. First, there's the Garden of Eden. Then the earth gets destroyed. And then God's people have to go to the land of Israel that he set apart for them. Then, while they're in Israel, there are famines. And the family goes to Egypt. You know, they get scattered into the world, where then, out in the world, out in Egypt, the family is reunited. Now, we're going to go backwards with this. We're coming to the time when the family is going to be coming back together. There are going to be famines of all kinds while we're still out here in Egypt in the world. Then we're going to go back to the land. Then the world is going to be cleansed like it was at Noah's flood. And then we're going to see the messianic kingdom, the Garden of Eden again. You see how that works? And so Genesis then is a prophecy going forward and backward. It's not just history or children's stories. But we need to understand that we have this general outline of how things are going to be, which is one of the reasons why, as I said in last week's Torah portion at the end of it, that time is a little bit different at the end of days than it was for the children of Israel back then. It gets compressed, as in like they were in the wilderness for 42 years. We'll be in the wilderness for 42 months. So that gives us a little bit better understanding of the timing and the events and how that all is going to work. Now, Exodus 1:7. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now, there's a couple of ways to look at this. First of all, I believe there are more of us in the world than we really realize. And secondly, fruitfulness pertains to both physical and spiritual fruitfulness. And of course, spiritual fruitfulness is always associated with keeping the Torah. So notice that this scripture says they were fruitful and they multiplied. So they were spiritually fruitful, keeping the Torah, and they multiplied physical. So I think we see this in the world today, and I believe that what we're seeing with the Hebrew Roots movement growing as fast as it is that we're starting to see this spiritual fruitfulness, and we truly don't really know how many of us there are. Okay, verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Well, I've taught this in the past about this king who arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And again, I'll repeat this and add some more to it. This Torah portion does not start out saying that it was a pharaoh. It was a king. And so this denotes a change in leadership style. And of course, in the last 4 years, the world has seen a change of leadership style all over the earth. So why does Scripture say that a new king arose that did not know Joseph? Well, We have to answer that question by asking this one. Why is there so little evidence of the Hebrews being in Egypt? You know, modern archaeologists have largely ignored anything having to do with Israel in Egypt. But not only are they ignoring it, but they're distorting it, they're denying it, and expunging the record. And so we have here, now today, we have the same thing going on. The record will be expunged. Obama and his Muslim brothers are going to attempt to expunge the record of the global Egypt. But, you know, there was a purpose for the children of Israel being in Egypt. The children of Israel were under Edomite kings because of what Jacob did when he came back into the land. What did he do? First of all, when he crossed over into the land, he had a struggle with the Messiah. But the very next thing that he did was he went to Esau and paid tribute to Esau and called Esau master. Well, you'll recall from prior Torah years, Torah cycles, that the children of Israel are told by the Lord that they will suffer from the sins of their fathers up to the third and fourth generation. Now, if you think about this, you will see that Jacob, being the first generation that went down into Egypt, there were three or four more generations after Jacob in Egypt where those children, his descendants, actually paid for their exile. They paid for what Jacob did to Esau. Let us not make this mistake again. We do not pay tribute to Esau, and we do not call Esau master. Part of coming out of Babylon is to stop participating with the Edomite master. That's why I do not call Obama president. He's not my president. He's not my master. He is an Edomite. Now, you can agree with me or disagree with me on that. I'm just telling you why I refuse to call that Edomite Muslim momser master. Ooh, I like that alliteration. That man that was king in Egypt here in Shemot was an Edomite. Now, most scholars will say that he was probably a Hyksos, but if you do the research, you will find out that they're now coming to the understanding that the Hyksos were descendants of Esau. They were Edomites, and it were the Hyksos who were kings in Egypt in those days, which very much parallels what is going on in the world today. Verse 9. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falls out any war, they join also to our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land." You know, right now, we see in the Arab uprisings and what's going on in Israel, as a matter of fact, and what's going on in the Western nations, is that there is a push to kill certain people. They're killing people that they think are going to rise up against them. We're having this thing about, you know, gun control right now because they don't want Jacob rising up against Esau. That's really, it's the spiritual thing that's going on. And so we're seeing come to pass in America and in other nations of the world, and particularly in the Middle East, where the Islamists are taking over and implementing Sharia law, that we are being driven out of countries and we're being killed persecution of Christians is on the rise, and it's all because what happened back then is going to happen today. So they are rising up and saying, come, let us deal wisely with them. And Obama thinks he's wise. He thinks that he can legislate every Friday afternoon by executive order some kind of new thing that's going to keep us from rising up and, taking back what we think is ours. And as a matter of fact, we need to remember to not rise up. These people here in Exodus, the children of Israel, did not rise up against their government, did they? So we need to be smart, even though our enemies are afraid that this is what we're going to do and they're taking away our guns. We need to make sure that we don't rise up against them. We have to let the Lord take care of this. Verse 11. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. And so they're going to inflict heavy burdens. And aren't we seeing those burdens come to pass? We're getting higher taxes, Obamacare, higher food prices, higher gas prices, and the federal government employment program is growing by leaps and bounds. Actually, there are more people working in the federal government now than there are in companies in the United States. So we're seeing that this is already being enacted upon us. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. Now, right here is where we get our first indication that the children of Israel were spreading beyond Goshen, where Joseph told them to stay. He gave them Goshen for their protection, but they have moved now outside of that boundary. They have spread abroad. If they had just stayed in Goshen, the Egyptians may not have been in such dread of them. Okay, verse 13. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. Now, that word rigor is the Hebrew word parek. It is Strong's 6531, and it means literally to break apart, to fracture. It also means severity, cruelty, rigor. So they were being broken apart. Now, I want to submit something to you about this, because we see that we are being broken apart in the Hebrew Roots movement, and it's coming because of disputes within the movement. But we also are not experiencing this bitter, hard bondage yet. And it could be, and I'm just throwing this out here. You may have some other ideas about this, and I would like to hear them. It may be that our hard bondage comes through the parek, the rigor that we're experiencing in the Hebrew Roots movement, and not so much having to be in hard bondage working as physical slaves, but that our slavery actually is inflicted upon ourselves by ourselves. But there are two other words here, mortar and brick. Mortar is a symbol of materialism. It's economic slavery. And bricks have to do with all the things that we want. We want the American dream. And what is the American dream? A house, children, a car, a job. It's all bricks, are all those same things that everybody wants. We've lost our ability to be individuals, unique, you know, and decide that we want some different things than what the rest of the world wants. So we're all just like a bunch of bricks. We all want the car, the house, the, you know, the kids, the, you know, to be the soccer mom and all of that. So we are falling into the mortar and bricks mentality. Exodus 1:15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of them was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, she shall live." Might I suggest that our current, for the last 40 or 50 years, abortion industry has not made a distinction between sons and daughters. They're just killing them all. They're killing everybody's children in order to make sure that there will not be a whole lot of Hebrews left alive in the world. Now, why was this the choice that the king made, to throw the male babies into the water? Well, if we go to Jasher chapter 67, start at verse 44, we will see there, and I'm not going to read it to you. We will see that there were three men there, Balaam, Job, and Jethro. By the way, Job was an Edomite, and now we know that it's possible for Edomites to serve the Lord, but to also make huge mistakes that cost them everything they have. And Jethro was Moses' future father-in-law, and he had said to the king that he should cease from destroying the children of Israel, but he said, "If it be not your will that they shall dwell in Egypt, send them forth from here that they may go to the land of Canaan." So Jethro was actually advocating throwing the children of Israel out of Egypt and not throwing them into the water. And so it says here, when Pharaoh heard the words of Jethro, he was very angry with him, and Jethro rose up with shame from the king's presence and went to Midian. That's where he lived, was in Midian, as we're going to see later. And what Job told the king, which got him into so much trouble, was that the king should just do whatever seemed good in his eyes. Well, what Balaam had just told the king before Jethro and Job spoke was that he should throw the male babies into the river. So basically, Job was agreeing with Balaam, but not coming right out and saying it. Verse 17, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this and let the male children live?' The midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them.' So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families." Verse 22, "Then Pharaoh commanded all his people." See, now we're going to move from, he's going to instruct just the few in the medical community, to now he's going to command all of his people, that every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So what he's doing here is he's getting the citizens of the country to turn against the Hebrews. So far, the reading of Shemot has been for the purpose of establishing the conditions under which the children of Israel have been living. Now, we can see that this is playing out in the world at large today, and of course, we don't know how much longer it's going to play out. As I said earlier, the Ephraimites thought that the time had come, and they decided to take it upon themselves to, you know, make the journey back to the land, and they ended up, all 30,000 of them, dead. So we don't know how much longer this is going to last. We're waiting for the altar to get set up, but if it doesn't get set up by this Passover and shut down by this Passover, we don't have a clue about when the Great Tribulation will start. So now let's go on to chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. Now that number there for that 3 months, you see, that is significant because it says in Hosea 6:2, after 2 days will he revive us. In the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Now, we can take that to mean in the third day after he has been here on earth. And for those of us who believe that we're somewhere in the beginning of that third day after Yeshua's life on earth, then we are looking for him to raise us up. Now, Exodus chapter 2, verse 3. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done with him. Now, at the time that this happened, Jochebed, that's Moses' mother, was 130 years old. Now, if you take the number 130 and add all the numbers together, you get 4. And 4 is the number of Messiah, and Moses had a miracle birth. And so this is a clue to us that he was a type and shadow of the Messiah. Now, we know that Miriam was the one who later would lead praise and worship. You know, the Lord said that he raised up Moses, Aaron, and Miriam to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. And so now Exodus 2:5 says, "Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it." Now the daughter's name here is Batya. The daughter of Pharaoh is Batya. Now it's very similar to the word Batya, which means daughter of Jehovah. So Batya is just B-A-T-H-I-A, Batya. The Egyptian spelling is just slightly different than the Hebrew spelling of B-A-T-Y-A-H. And in fact, there are ladies in the Hebrew Roots movement who are named Batya today. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So isn't this interesting? Jochebed gets to work for wages, nursing her own child. You see how the Lord just blesses us when we do what he wants us to do. Exodus chapter 2, verse 10, "When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, 'I drew him out of the water.'" Now, the root word of the name Moses actually it's Moshe, and the root word of that means take out or draw out. Now, Moses' name is actually, as I said, is a Hebrew name, is Moshe. And the Egyptian specialists also, the language specialists of Egypt, say that this name Moshe, even though it is a Hebrew name, it means son in Egyptian. But there's a little bit more that we need to understand about this name Moshe, because the way it's spelled is Mem Shin He. Now, if you turn that around backwards, what you get is He Shin Mem. And what is that? It is the name. It's Hashem. if you turn it around backwards. And now, starting in verse 11, we read about how Moses ended up having to leave Egypt. First, he killed an Egyptian that was beating on a Hebrew man. And the next day, he was out watching two Hebrews fighting with each other and said something to them, and they said something about Moses killing the Egyptian the day before. But they also said something to him. You'll remember that when Joseph had his dreams and Jacob said to him, "Are you expecting me and your mother and all your brethren to bow down to you?" And the brethren did not like the fact that his dreams said that they would bow down to him. They said, "What, are you going to be ruler over us?" You see? Well, this is kind of the same thing that went on here with these men. They said, "Who made you a prince and judge over us?" You see, they are saying to him the same thing that the brothers said to Joseph about being a ruler over them. And then they said, "Do you intend to kill us like you killed the Egyptian?" And so Moses feared for his life and left Egypt, and rightly so, because in verse 15 it says, "Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses." So Moses left and went into the area where Midian was with his seven daughters, and we see there that he was able to get Zipporah for his wife. Now, the book of Jasher tells us that before Moses went to the area of Midian, where he got Zipporah, that he was king of Cush. Now, it makes sense to me that Moses spent some time ruling in Cush, because he did develop really good leadership skills, although later he would tell the Lord that he wasn't very good at making speeches. Moses did seem to have good leadership skills, but something else happened to him out there in the desert. I believe that when he became king of Cush, and also when he went into the desert around the area of Midian, that he began to experience humility. He began to mature, just like Joseph did. Joseph matured enough to not blame his brothers for what happened to him. And I believe that Moses went through that same process of not blaming his Hebrew brethren for him being outside of Egypt and not being ruler in Egypt, but that he finally came to understand that the Lord had done this to raise him up. And at a certain point, I think he will understand this. So being out of Egypt and being in Midian, being in Cush, those are all life experiences that Moses needed to have before he could come back and do the will of the Lord. And isn't that often the way it is? You know, I will tell you that the Lord told me I would have a ministry when I was just a teenager, but I did not get that ministry until I was in my 50s. There was a long period of learning and maturing. So I think that what is going on here with Moses is that he is preparing Moses to be able to rise to the occasion, and he is allowing the children of Israel to fulfill what he said in Genesis 15, that they would be in the land of Egypt for four generations. And so there's a couple of things going on here. If Moses had jumped the gun like the Ephraimites did and thought that he could defy Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of the land early, that would have also been a huge mistake. So the Lord had a whole lot of reasons why he took Moses out into the desert and into those other experiences. But in chapter 3, we now see how humbled Moshe has become. In chapter 2, he was bold enough to kill Egyptians who were beating on the Hebrews. But in chapter 3, which is 80 years later, he doesn't think of himself as a god anymore. He thinks of himself now as a shepherd. Here in Exodus chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law." And so we see that God is now establishing Moshe as the kind of leader that will be required in order to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. And that kind of leader is one who is strong, who has leadership capability, but who is also humble. These kinds of men are hard to find. Now, in verse 2 it says, "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed." Now, this angel of the Lord, every time it says angel of the Lord, I do believe that it's speaking about Yeshua. And so it was Yeshua there who would be calling to Moses. And that's significant because we're going to find out who this is. Who is Yeshua? "And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I." Now look. We here in verse 2 have the angel of the Lord appearing in the flame of fire. And then we have here in verse 4 that the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, and God called him out of the midst of the bush. It's pretty plain from here, and it's plain in many other places too, that the angel of the Lord and God are all the same person. And the angel of the Lord, as I have said, is Yeshua. And he said, draw not nigh hither, put off your shoes from off your feet, for the place whereon you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land into a good land and a large, into a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come to me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, Certainly I will be with you, and this shall be a token to you, that I have sent you, that you have brought forth, when you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. And so, what is this mountain? This is Mount Sinai. And again, in the next few Torah portions, we're going to see this same one, the one that's called the angel of the Lord, and the one that comes with fire, and the one who calls himself God, he's going to be there on Mount Sinai. Verse 13, And Moses said to God, Behold, when I come to the children of Israel, and shall say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? So God, the Lord, the angel of the Lord, has identified himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why would he need to identify himself in that way instead of saying, I am the God that created the heavens and the earth? Why did he need to say, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Well, we know that all of the deities, if you go and look at any pagan myth about their deity, you will learn that they all lay claim to having created the heaven and the earth. So the Lord had to say something to Moses to give to the children of Israel that would identify him as being specifically for Israel, and that was that he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in verse 14, he said to Moses, I am that I am. And thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Now, this is the first time that we ever have this phrase being said in association with the Lord. It is Hayah Asher Hayah. Now, the reason that the Lord said, I am that I am to Moshe is because Moshe had just questioned whether the Hebrews would believe that it was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that had sent him. And so the Hebrews were going to want an identifier, as I just said. But that's what this phrase is. It is the identifier. How is it an identifier? Well, it's because it is the only phrase that denotes eternality. You know, he couldn't just come out and say, I am the eternal God. That's because all the other pagan deities, all those demon deities, they also claim eternality. So he needed a phrase, a way to denote eternality, so that they would recognize that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is also this eternal one. That's why we have two identifying things going on here. Moshe is going to go say, this I am that I am is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the phrase I am that I am denotes eternality. It is a phrase that is always spoken in the present tense, but the past and future tenses are contained within it. It is always ever present. And is that not what our Jehovah is? He is always present, yet we know that he existed in the past and that he will exist in the future. This was such a unique way for the Lord to identify himself to the Hebrews. Immediately after that, the Lord begins to instruct Moses what he is going to do in the land of Egypt, that he's going to go before the king of Egypt and ask for the king to let them go 3 days' journey into the wilderness. And he says, Moses, I'm sure the king is not going to let you go. I'm going to stretch out my hand and smite Egypt, and I'm going to give favor to the Hebrews in the sight of the Egyptians. You will not go out empty-handed, but you are going to go out to your land. I'm going to take you back to the land of your inheritance. And so this is the instruction that Moses got from the Lord. Now, in chapter 14, Moshe angers the Lord by doubting, and he's finding all kinds of excuses not to do what the Lord wanted. The excuse that Moses used was that he's not a very good speaker, and so it ended up that Aharon would do the speaking for Moses, but it would be Moses who would show the signs of the staff that the Lord was going to give him to show the Egyptians. And so one of those signs was not just to the Egyptians, but was to the Hebrews. It was the sign of leprosy. So in chapter 5, Moshe and Aharon go to the king, and they do the miracles with the staff that the Lord told them to do. And Moshe put his hand in his cloak, and it came out leprous. And he put his hand back in his cloak, and it came out clean. But this had no effect on Pharaoh. He went ahead and made the lives of the children of Israel even harder. So now we get to see what things are coming. And I hope that this Torah portion has helped you and given you a better understanding of the things that are coming to us by understanding what came to them. So please go and study these things. Don't take what I say. You verify it for yourself. You go do your own study. It's good to listen to teachers. I think we all should listen. In fact, I listen to lots of teachers, but I verify what they say. And you should do that with all the teachers yourself. So I hope that you've been blessed. Shabbat Shalom.